We want to reflect this afternoon on the subject of community life and friendship. When I approached this subject, I asked myself, which should I talk about, community life or friendship? Because I believe in many people's minds, there is a built-in contradiction between authentic community life and genuine friendship. I hope as a result of our few reflections and whatever inspirations God can give you, you will see that they are not mutually exclusive. There are many reasons for speaking about both subjects and a special reason for speaking about the two together. As regarding community life, it is a matter of common knowledge and fast becoming for most of us of common experience that perhaps the greatest crisis facing religious institutes is the crisis of community. I don't think it is basically a matter of authority, though that's part of it, nor even of obedience, though that too is part of it, or the newfound freedom and the change of old structures, though that is part of it. I believe that quintessentially, what religious institutes must solve, and some are painfully now trying to solve, is what is a community. And as we recede, or at least dispense with some of the external forms of that which, as we believed, constituted community, we have got to be more than ever clear about what is the interior spiritual basis of that which communizes people who accept for their common dedication of Christ would otherwise never have met, let alone when they face each other on the evening of their entrance day and they say, does this mean we're going to spend our lives together? In other words, communities must find something interior in the human heart and above them in the grace of God, which will not only keep them together by some kind of common profession or work, but by something which transcends both professions and the apostolic needs even of their community. Otherwise, there is risk, as we are seeing in some places, of disintegration. On the other hand, as regarding friendship, this is just by way of prologue, as regarding friendship, we know that there are things being written and said that less than 5 years ago would not have been written or said. We've got to make some assessment of that. Has human nature changed? Have the demands of human affection been so affected by modern times that what we were so sedulous to protect not 10 years ago, we now have a newfound freedom to indulge? I will concentrate, because I think it is more fundamental, on the subject of friendship, and related as occasion arises to community. What do we mean by friendship? Notice we are not talking exactly about friendliness, but friendship. I would define it generically as the mutual exchange of affection. It means, therefore, some kind of exchange, which means that somehow the two people mutually show to each other that they care. It is mutual in that they somehow share alike. It is not genuine friendship if affection is not reciprocated. In fact, if it isn't soon reciprocated, what may have looked like a friendship can become hatred. So mutual exchange is of the essence. A one-sided love is never friendship, but it is affection, by which we imply that it is something which is deeply interior and involves mainly the will and the affections, or if you wish, the volitional and emotional parts of our being. And before we go on to examine this, let's just say one word so we don't miss our bearings. I can't be on the friendliest of terms with a person whom I can call my dearest friend on earth and be thousands of miles from him, may not have seen him for the last 10 years, may not hope to see him before heaven. And why? Because genuine friendship is authentically interior. And where we are dealing with two spiritual beings, which is what friendship implies, why, there will be a mutual exchange of affection. Its manifestation may be minimal, most infrequent, and may indeed be completely silent. Yet the two know that they are, in the deepest human sense, friends. The kind of friendship is what needs to be unraveled in the 45 or 50 minutes that I usually give myself for these meditations. We can hardly hope to exhaust a subject on which volumes have been and more are being written. I would, however, for the sake of clarity, divide friendships, whether authentic or pseudo, into four classes. Each form, as I understand it, depends upon the motive, the reason why there is friendship between these people. All kinds of other possible categories, the one that I like best, it helps to make it clearest to me, and I hope will be somewhat clear to you how they differ. Now, before we enter into an analysis, let me say that it is not always easy to distinguish among the four between any two, especially, say, the first and second, or the third and fourth. And what may sometimes one day be one kind, the next day may suddenly become the other, either by sublimation or by degeneracy. Nothing is more mercurial than friendship, because it depends on the most mercurial of things, and that is the human will. And you never know, never, except with God, what another human being, for that matter, you yourself, will think or how you will feel, I don't say tomorrow, but in the next hour. And this fluctuation is also good to know, because it makes one prudent and wise in the handling of this delicate, yet, as I will try to point out, the important subject. The four kinds, first to mention them and then briefly to analyze. I begin at the bottom. I could start at the top. You take your pick. Now, the lowest rung is sexual friendship. This may also be called venereal. As the name implies, it is as low as you can get. The second I call sensual. And because it involves the feelings, it may also be called emotional. The third, for want of a better word, because it involves so many varieties, I prefer to denominate psychological. And because of it being so common among a certain class of people, it is by psychologists or theologians of psychology, sometimes called professional. And finally, There is spiritual friendship, the highest of its kind, which, because it implies and demands the constant influx of divine help, is also called supernatural. Let's begin at the bottom with just a few paragraphs about each. Sexual friendship, as the adjective tells us, involves two people, it could be more, but generally speaking, two people who are deeply interested in each other. Make no mistake. It may have all sorts of external manifestations that look like other kinds of higher friendship. Yet, it is not only selfish, but in the worst sense, sinful. It involves, of course, a discovery that this person, or at most with some, these persons, a few, give satisfaction to one's libidinal appetites, and as a consequence, because these people give me more satisfaction than others, as takes place, for example, in premarital or extramarital relations, a husband having relations with another woman, and really would call her his friend, devoted to her in many ways. Yet that which keeps these two people together is their mutual anatomical interest in each other's sexual organs. Speaking to religious and about religious, if we ever had any doubts that these kind of friendships are possible, though they can become manifest and can end in tragedy for individuals or whole communities, I think by now we should be disillusioned about this thing being too far removed from convent walls. It isn't. No priest, no counselor religious, who knows men and women, ever had any doubts. And now it is so publicized, no one should question. This is both a possibility and a danger affecting, I would say, all religious communities. The reason why, I will add in just a few minutes. The fact is there. It involves two things that need to be said. The one is that anyone is subject to this kind of attraction and corresponding sexual friendship. No one is exempt. When I say no one, I mean just that. And not infrequently, the very young are better protected than the middle-aged. They themselves, being still young, having the fire of youth and adolescence, having been only a few years away from dating, relationship for women with men, they may well use their heads. Middle-aged women may be less cautious. It is something, secondly, which is being stimulated as never before. Now, we talked in a previous context in talking about chastity that never before has modern, certainly American culture, been more sexually active. It's the most popular activity in America, in case you don't know. And as a consequence, this hypersexual activity affects our society. And where not too many years ago, we might expect a certain quiescence of the sexual drive, we cannot bank on it now. There are too many things around us to arouse the passions. But secondly, in terms of those sex stimuli, I've never given a retreat, even a weekend retreat, without mentioning this. Men, women, priests, religious, doesn't matter. know your sex stimuli, with the emphasis on the pronominal adjective your. No two people are the same. There are some things that would set an iceberg on fire. There are some situations in which no woman can be placed without being sexually aroused. And speaking for men, there are a lot of situations which no normal man, be he bishop or paperboy, can resist. But we're not talking about those obvious sex stimuli which are common to every normal human being. And if we're not normal sexually, we shouldn't be in the convent. If we're normal, we're going to be stimulated. But here's the point. We are all different. We talked about individuality in our previous meditation. Let me here speak of the individuality of knowing ourselves as persons. No two of us have the same past experience. No two of us have the same images in our imagination. No two of us have had the same previous sex experience. Some, thank God, have had none. And they're not always people with a milky chastity either. But God has spared them, and they've been smart enough and strong enough to remain chaste. I have met, no chance in a million of identifying them, women 30, 40 years in religion who I know had never once deliberately indulged in a sexual pleasure. At the other extreme, there are women who enter the convent who, to put it very frankly, are not virgins. And they too belong. And some time ago, when I was asked to assist in the revision of constitutions, and I read to my horror, one of the conditions for valid entrance was virginity. Well, I underlined my criticism and I said, whatever you do, don't put that condition in. It's wrong. The greatest woman lover of Christ after his mother was a prostitute. Know your own sex stimuli. What arouses you? And you cannot look to others for guidance here. You just can't. Nobody can give you direction. You've got to know yourself and be honest. And with a little reflection and some honest sincerity, we know pretty well how much we can take. It's like a person with propensity to drink knows where he must stop. And for some, it means almost complete abstinence. Though, of course, notice what I'm saying. Abstinence from any sex stimulation is almost impossible. In fact, it is impossible. Certainly in apostolic life. Yet there's such a thing as not guarding the eyes, reading, and especially for women, in lecturing to people in psychology on this subject, and it's a very broad distinction, somewhat inadequate, but will help. What women read stimulates them. What men see stimulates them. Is the human body, its exposure and shape that stimulate a man, its imagination, ideas, in large measure coming from reflecting, imagining, and that in turn from reading, that stimulates women. A man will read a drippingly romantic novel of 600 pages only at the point of a gun. It's disgusting. He gets no excitement at all except to go to sleep. A woman, by page 6, may be on fire. Let me say a word here about this sexual friendship involving not only, as we would ordinarily expect, men and women, but also, for yourselves, between women. Homosexuality is always a danger in religious life, whether all men or all women. And lest you forget, and just to have heard it once in a retreat, the amount of sex stimulation going on in the world around us arouses women, and their first object of sexual interest is a fellow religious. May I suggest just a few obvious things as one who has dealt with people struggling, people becoming saints in fighting this passion, and others in falling into the gutter because in most cases they didn't have sense enough to get direction. If there is one rule I would give you, sisters, is be sure you watch your hands. There are certain people you simply cannot touch, and most obviously in certain parts of the body. But I say just touch. Now, as a man, I must say I cannot appreciate. I sometimes smile when I see it. When I see two sisters, for example, from distant missions, coming back, say, from Puerto Rico, and they meet in Detroit. They haven't seen each other for 10 long months. So they meet. Well, I meet one of my fellow Jesuits, and I say, "Hiya, Jim," or I shake hands with him. Well, these two religious. Well, you know what happens. We call that the amplexus, which means they are in a clutch. Now, I suppose on such occasions, given the circumstances, it is both legitimate and no doubt praiseworthy. Care, however, in embracing people, unless the occasion calls for it, and especially when you find that your tendency to embrace favors one person, a big red sign should go on. Stop. In the name of God, stop. I would like to insert a couple of sentences here on some of the guff being written, some in otherwise pretty good magazines, some of it by men and women who should know better. I know some of them who write this. I try to reason with them. Those whom I know who write about the easy relationship between sisters and men, including priests, the need they have for developing, you know all the terms that are being coined now. Those that I know who write this way, and this is really true, are naive. There was such a thing as armchair theology. You know what I mean. Reading one book and writing another one. Do you know one of the main reasons why I give retreats, sisters? When I get home, all my mail stops when I come here. It's an avalanche. One of the main reasons I give retreats, I hope to be of some assistance to those to whom I speak, is that I might learn from experience, from dealing with souls, struggling with them, seeing their aspirations to sanctity and their trials and temptations, so that when I face a class of young Jesuits, I won't be talking through my hat. And I tell my young priests, especially in fourth year theology, most of us, as you know, are in education, and the majority are now going into universities. I always have a sprinkling of PhDs in my classes. and by and large they're all finished with their graduate studies. And I tell them, whatever you do in God's name, remain confessors till the day of your death, so you won't be lecturing or writing about those unrealities which don't exist in the world of flesh and blood. I write too in a lecture, but I want to make sure, and that's why I'm sharing with you, sisters, I read this stuff, but I know on both sides the people who write that don't know human nature from dealing with it intimately, and those who are taken in by it are naive. Second kind of friendship, the sensual. Here it involves the feelings. It may be called, properly understood, romantic. It may be described as the pleasant experience I have when I'm in somebody else's company. Now, I suppose the other is more common, the unpleasant experience I have when I'm in other people's company. You get what I mean. Where do you start? How do you describe it? Analyze it, you can. It's like proving that this paper is white. I wanted to make sure there's nothing written on the other side. How do you prove this is white? Well, it's not black. Well, why is that black and this is white? You can't prove it. You can only experience it. So here, the warm feeling, the sense of well-being that comes when I am in another person's company, the person with whom I can talk for 2 hours, whereas somebody else, I am fidgety and stumbling for words after 2 minutes. Right? And if you don't have the experience, you're not human. So we're all human. In itself, it is not genuine friendship yet. Why not? Because friendship which is genuine seeks the benefit or the welfare of the other, even though it may foresee that I will be benefited by my benefiting the other. And as you know, there's nothing pays richer dividends than love. All right. But the purpose in this case is I feel good. I like her company. Why? I don't know. And frankly, you say, I don't care. Now, I think you can correct me on this, though I don't know how you could, because you'd have to know the other side. I think women are more prone to this kind of friendship than men. Now, men have their problems. Don't misunderstand me. But I think a sensual or emotional friendship between, especially, say, two women, whether in the convent or out of it, is more common than among men. Here, the caution I would give, the obvious one, is sensual friendship, unless carefully watched, tends to become sexual. What are some bread and butter rules that I've struggled with souls who are having trouble with the first kind or were getting towards the sexual? To ask oneself, how much am I in another person's company? You may be shocked. How many sisters were on your mission last year? 12, including the superior and yourself. The one sister that you suspect you were emotionally friendly with, how much time did you spend with her? Figure it out. Count the number of waking hours and maybe past curfew hours that you were with her. Add it up. You may discover to your horror, though there were 11 others in that community, you spent 11 times as much time with her as with anyone else. Time, then. The way to control an emotional friendship is to watch the amount of time. Second, It is not only the amount of time that I spend with someone else, it is how solitary, or in this case exclusive, is my relationship. And if I find that I am generally with her alone, and that in fact we don't even begin to talk except about the weather outside until the strangers go away. A third good norm that I found useful, it's not in books, is what do we talk about? And a good way to control this emotional friendship is to ask oneself, now it may be, sisters, it may be, that one person in that community you are spending 11 times as much with as anybody else, but she is such a saintly soul, and her advice and counsel on matters academic is so indispensable for your apostolate that the time is not only well spent, it is the most profitable in your week. Maybe, but find out. I think on second or third thoughts, you will discover that a lot of that time is spent in talking about what? That's not the right question. In talking about whom. And by just a little shrewd but honest, be honest with God, be honest towards God, and by the way, you will be in the degree to which you are honest with yourselves. The third kind of friendship we call, or I call, the psychological. This kind we know about, we've no doubt experienced, and as we become more and more involved in various pursuits, we shall find people of other than religious interests, we becoming friendly with them and they with us. And this, by the way, needs some exploration as religious communities allow more freedom in dealing with, say, seculars. But lest you miss my point, don't forget that what I said about the sexual and sensual applies just as much to one who is not a member of the community as to members of the community. Let me not restate the obvious. But now this third, the psychological, this is the first of what I call genuine friendships. Why is it genuine? Because its motivating force is the welfare of the other. Friendship begins where self leaves off. Up to that point, it is basically selfishness, no matter how masked. It is therefore among people with an interest in something outside of themselves. That's the usual form it takes. It is most common, as I'm sure you know, and as you become more involved in professional pursuits, among people with a common interest in some field like literature or the sciences, in my own case, in education. I have some wonderful friends who are not Jesuits, not priests, not Christians. One of my dearest friends, he is a Jewish rabbi, and after 10 years of friendship and correspondence, I was with him for 3 days at Chicago University this summer, and I almost fell off my chair in the lunchroom when he told me. He said, John, you know what I'm doing next year? His name is Arthur, Rabbi Arthur Gilbert. Can't imagine. I'm taking a job teaching at Marymount College in New York. You ever hear of it? A Catholic college for women. He's going to teach in a Catholic college. Going to teach about Judaism, and he's going to teach about Christianity. He'll never become a Christian. Not Gilbert's. But he's seeing the light. This kind of friendship is the basis of all great achievements anywhere, in business, industry, the arts, the sciences. It is only because people who have been willing to sacrifice themselves to the hundreds of hours in working with things that I was involved in that I could even begin to do the things that I've done. This summer, I'm sorry I couldn't bring him along. He left, in fact, just before I came here to Farmington. All summer long, a young seminarian from the Lansing Diocese worked with me. All day, as he told his friends, all night, he was kidding. I didn't work him that hard. He didn't get a cent. He's, of course, much younger than I. He wants to get the experience of what it means to write and become involved in that kind of profession. His father teaches at Michigan State, a young man of great promise. This kind of friendship is beneficial, very healthy. It is, in a good sense, selfless, because it means that the work that I do, much of which I'm speaking for all of us, that we do individually, could not be done except that other people are willing to put themselves out. For what? For the common pursuit of a common goal. Unless this kind of friendship obtains in a community, that school or hospital is in trouble. And any time religious begin to think in terms of a 40-hour week, or a punching a clock, or do I have to do it, or waiting for the sign on the bulletin board before they move, this, may I suggest you ask yourselves, how much of this you are giving to others, how able you are to win this kind of friendship on the part of others. And even if it means, as it may sometimes mean, two people working closer together than anyone else in that community, provided this is the level on which they work, God will bless it. And let me say, the others should keep their envious or jealous eyes off those people. But notice, I've protected myself because I've already talked about two other kinds of pseudo-friendships. Finally, the highest spiritual friendship. This can be seen and is read about in the pages of Christian hagiography obtained between such great saints as Francis and Claire, Claude and Margaret Mary, Francis de Sales, De Chantal. And over the years, in any professional person's work, and for us as religious and priests, God may, notice I'm qualifying, He may send such a person into our lives. Many lives, great lives, have been lived and died without the experience of this kind of friendship. If it does not come our way, it may be the price of our religious life. If it does come our way, we'll know it. Let me describe it. Let me make a few observations. Its purpose, remember, we are talking about motivation behind each kind of friendship. The purpose in this case being utterly selfless, wanting only the welfare of the other, in this case, the spiritual welfare of the person whom I called, as Christ called his disciples, friends. I wish them well, that God might love them more, that I might become better religious, or better priest, or better lay people. It is obtained among the saints, and I feel safe in saying that not infrequently, it has helped to create certain saints. It is both possible and, with God's grace, feasible. Let me, however, add a few observations. This kind of friendship is not easily come by. You don't pick up these friends on the street corner. Secondly, this kind of friendship is not, you'll understand my words when I use them, love at first sight. There's a backlog. There's a development. There's a growing awareness. There is above all a growing purification of self. Now, with this purification of self that I want to talk about, because I have seen otherwise not stupid people quite literally quoting from the great pages of some of the great saints and having the incredible gall to peddle this in the marketplace and to sell it to all comers as though you can come buy this by putting a nickel into a slot and pushing a button. How dumb can you be? This kind of friendship is developed only through sacrifice. And it means exactly that. And between two people who really love each other in the way in which Christ loved his friends, and among them he had one particular friend who in his modesty even forbore identifying himself by name except to say the disciple whom Jesus loved. And Christ is our model. It cannot be wrong. And anyone who says it is blasphemes. But notice, from saying it is good and saying that this or that particular clinch is a spiritual friendship is an abuse of human language, because a sacrifice which precedes sometimes for years, this kind of friendship means that they may not see each other for years, or if they do, they are too wise in the ways of God to suppose for a moment that God would bless this kind of friendship and allow it to fructify into that holy relationship which has made the saints, while allowing the rest of the community to stand by in the freeze. Now a brief epilogue. I need hardly repeat, yet I will, that what we most need in the religious life, most need, after God's grace, and that's assumed, is human love. We need it. And as I've found, there are certain formulas I've used, usually simple words, nothing much over a monosyllable, and short sentences, in giving homilies for 4 years to my dear patients at the state hospital. Every once in a while, they would get up in the middle of my sermon and tell me, "Nice going, Father." I told them in so many ways, and I tell you, the human heart needs love as the human body needs food. If it does not have enough or the right kind, it becomes weak and sick. And if deprived, it dies. And the death of the human spirit as surely follows the lack of human love as the body dies without food. Now the problem that faces all of us, me as well as you, and that I commend to your prayers and reflection, because whatever else you would like to solve, I'm sure you want to handle this one. How to live in a community with six or 60, which means living together, sharing everything as far as possible, and at the same time finding that kind of human affection and love which we need. Let me observe that we cannot, and I mean cannot, not merely do not, we cannot love all people alike. I don't know how it got into some books. Should be cut out with a sharp razor. You cannot love everybody alike. How do I know that? to repeat what we mentioned before, Christ himself, as man, did not love all alike. Because we love according to the qualities that we see in others, and consequently it is perfectly consonant with the best lived community to prefer the friendship or the company of some to that of others. Nothing wrong. The obvious qualification is that I do not so monopolize another person's time or affection as to be a detriment to that community. It means, moreover, that while I am to be friendly with everyone, my friendship, by definition, will be with few. But notice, I am qualifying and insisting that I am friendly with everyone. And it can well be that my community life will cause me to make sacrifice of my genuine, deep affection for some one person whose spiritual interests I have at heart and that I do not want to injure, and that as a consequence I will, and I use the word advisedly, sacrifice manifestations of my affection. The exchange of things that people who are in friendship contribute to one another. How frequently we see each other, what we say to one another, provided I am willing to make that sacrifice, God in his wisdom and goodness will help us to purify our affections. And this is my prayer, that he will give you the secret of discovering in community life genuine human love among your fellow sisters and indeed among other human beings. Yet never in such a way as to selfishly preoccupy that person's love to the detriment of his or her spiritual life, and of course, not to your own. I'd like to end with a little formula. Rather than speak, as we so often do, about what they call exclusive friendships, I don't like the word, because it seems to somehow imply that, well, if I am friendly with one person, I am unfriendly with somebody else. I rather prefer degrees of friendship. Note the difference. So that there is no one whom I call my friend to the point of almost excluding others, but that within a community or within the ambit of the people that God puts into my life, and he will put a lot of lovable people into your lives, there will be degrees of your affection for them, and that you will not hesitate, because Christ did not, to love some more than others, but no one to the exclusion of anyone. Shall we pray? In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, amen. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. O Mary, conceived without sin. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, amen.